You have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here, Business Broker Growth Show guest episode. Today I'm very excited. This is a first. I have Mr. Restaurant Broker on the show. It's a first to have someone focused on restaurants. I love it. I'm excited. I've been waiting for this for a while. We even had to reschedule, but I've got Mr. Dominique Maddox. He is the founder and president of Eats Broker. He's always on brand. He's always on point. He's here on the show with us today. Dominique, welcome to the Business Broker Growth Show.
Man, I appreciate the intro. I appreciate the opportunity. I need to record that, but definitely appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to our conversation today.
Luckily, you being here, I will send you a copy of this and you can find it everywhere podcasts are sold. Just like everyone who's tuning in. So, I am excited. Like, I know I say this a lot. Any long-term listeners, like, you know, I mention this from time to time where I'm truly excited. I love having conversations like this. And then you have this interesting journey of life and then into brokerage and then into restaurants and this path that you went through. And so, you know, again, I could read the bio and intro. I'm not going to because I just want to kick it off with a conversation. So you're born and raised in Alaska.
Born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska.
I'm Anchorage, Alaska.
Native. Yes.
You're Alaska native. You get yourself to the contiguous 48 states. You get yourself to Atlanta, and you go to college. And what happens on this path? How does a guy from Alaska make his way to where he is now?
Well, that's a great question. One big part of my story is I made a highlight tape of myself and I put it on a VCR tape and I mailed it out to different athletic departments. That's how I got recruited to Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. They received one of my VCR tapes, put it in the VCR player, and then they called me on the landline and said, hey, we want you to fly out to Atlanta. So that's how I ended up from Anchorage, Alaska to Atlanta, Georgia. I lived there for 18 years. In 2008, I got into real estate when the market was going down. I got my real estate license. I just thought it was a great idea. Hey, let me get a real estate license when the market is going down. So by the time it bounces back, I'll be established. And after 2 years of doing residential real estate, I knew I didn't like residential real estate. Always had a dream of getting into commercial real estate. And I started doing my research. How do you get into commercial real estate? Well, they tell you go interview with different firms. And I had two different interviews with two different commercial real estate companies and they didn't hire me. And I was kind of getting bummed out. I'm like, how am I ever gonna get into commercial real estate? And one day I received an email in September of 2010, was like, have you ever thought about being an intermediary that sells restaurants? I'm like, what is that? Like, so I'm like, sure. I came in for the interview, interviewed with a large restaurant brokerage firm, worked there for 7 years. And got to the point where I was just like, hey, I want to start my own restaurant brokerage firm. So I started Eats Broker October of 2019. And in August of 2021, I decided to move to Dallas, Texas, because I knew the market in Dallas was just growing. It's a booming market. And within 5 years of living in Dallas, Texas, I've established Eats Broker as one of the top restaurant brokerage firms in the state of Texas.
And I love it. There's so many things that I really enjoy and appreciate about you and the journey, which is the VCR tape. And for this, a whole bunch of people potentially watching this or listening to this that have no idea what that is, or they've heard about it from their grandparents maybe, but you know, to do that and send that off and like that focus and that drive, and then, you know, call it's smart in retrospect at the time. Obviously seems crazy to get a real estate license in 2008 when the world is collapsing and falling apart, but to think like, hey, let me get it now. Let me, you know, go through the growing learning process, which is the opposite. Everyone else is running away. You're like, hey, it seems like a good time when everyone's, exactly, you know, selling, that's a good time to buy. Right. Like in that kind of mindset. And then, you know, getting into intermediary, what was it about the intermediary role, the business broker thing that appealed to you and got you hooked?
Well, one big thing is if I didn't get a football scholarship, my backup plan was going to be to go to culinary art school to be a chef. That was plan B.
Didn't know that.
Yes. And I got a football scholarship, so I decided not to go to culinary art school. So I've always had a love of food. I'm the cook in the house. I used to be my Grammy sous chef. I love to go in. I watch cooking shows all the time. So I'm a 100% foodie. So having the opportunity to be a consultant in the restaurant brokerage industry was very fascinating to me. It was different. It was going into commercial. And the great thing is you go around and eat at so many different restaurants. So I was like, count me in. I love it. So it's been the best decision I ever made in my life is to become a restaurant broker.
That's awesome. Side note, I'm going to guess I already know the answer. Anchorage, Alaska, Atlanta, Georgia, and that surrounding area, where you are now in Texas, which one has the best food?
Great question. Great question. All very different cuisines, because like in a place like Alaska, we'll eat moose and caribou are very delicious. Where you come down to Texas, a lot of Tex-Mex, and then you go to Atlanta, more Southern style feel. But the best I would have to say is it has to be Texas. There's so many restaurants here. And you got so many different places. You have Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, very big markets. So Texas, 100%.
Yeah, Texas, 100%. Hopefully you're a big barbecue guy.
100%. I'm big on smoking, using different woods. I'm really a foodie. I watch all the cooking shows and Pitmasters shows. I love those.
That's awesome. That's a great show. I could totally see it. I was going to make a joke about it being required that you have to eat barbecue once a week in Texas, but yeah. So great. That's a great, fun, let's say intersection with the foodie side of you, restaurant brokerage, right? I don't think there's any other industry niche focused business broker that's probably as fun as that, right? Like I've had some people on the show that are focused on home health care, doctor's offices, roofing. And one coming up is HVAC. Nobody gets to go there and sample the HVAC when they, work with their clients. Not like you do.
Well, I would say it's definitely one of the funnest, but also it's one of the most challenging, because there's so many people that are in the restaurant industry as owners. There is a lot of creative bookkeeping, books and records, and there's a high failure rate. 80% of restaurants fail within 5 years. And a lot of times they don't plan exit strategy. Most people that contact us is something that happened that triggers them. Hey, I have to sell, rather than we prepared to sell. And so it's a very challenging industry. But the good side of it is, yes, I try so many different cuisines. I love Indian, Asian, barbecue, soul food. I try it all. So I stay in the gym. Yeah. I got to work out at least 3 times a week to look decent, because I'm eating, I don't pass on a meal when my potential clients or clients ask me, hey, Dominic, you want something to eat? I always say I'm a big guy. Yes, I want something to eat. So, I love
always. And it's interesting you said about the challenges too, right? So there's the fun part and being able to sample things and try things, and that definitely helps. But you're right. I see this a lot, because I talk to a lot of brokers where so many of them don't even want restaurants, right? They don't want to deal with it. In fact, I know brokers that have come from a restaurant hospitality background, and they're like, I don't want those. So let's talk about that. Like, what are the things, you said creative books, you said people who aren't ready to sell, and you said that something happens in life. What are the type of things that are popping up and causing them to sell? And then what's that conversation like? What are you doing in those moments?
Well, one of the biggest things is baby boomers. Baby boomers are looking at retiring. Baby boomers are realizing that their kids don't want to take over their restaurant. And they need, and a lot of times it may be the biggest asset that they have or the biggest liability that they have. So now it's time to talk about how do we get out of that business? And then the bigger thing that a lot of restaurant owners do is they don't plan their exit when they're getting in the business. Meaning that they spend all this money building out their restaurant, or they're signing these terrible leases that they don't think about when it's time to exit. How will that affect me? I have a guy who has a great restaurant. He's built it up. You look at his lease, the landlord owns all the equipment. So he has nothing to put on the asset purchase agreement. So what we're selling is just goodwill. Wow. And that's, yeah, so it's and there's just a lot of uneducation when it comes to a lot of people that don't understand of what it takes to keep a restaurant successful. It's a lot. It's all about the numbers. And I can know if a restaurant is successful just by asking a couple of different numbers. First number I want to know is your rent percentage. Is your rent percentage 10% or lower or 10% higher? Because anytime the rent is 10% of the gross sales, then I know that that restaurant has a higher chance of not being successful. I have people coming to me and their rent is 18% of gross sales, 20% of gross sales, 22% of gross sales. That's a horrible lease.
Yeah. And is that because they're in a location that warrants that high, or they just didn't know what they were getting into or wanted that location in particular and just got stuck?
Both. A lot of it is that people go into restaurants with projections. And you can project whatever you're going to do, but the reality is you may not reach those projections. And so they're basing these rent amounts off projections. And when reality kicks in, it's like, okay, we're over our head in debt. We need to sell. And it's going to be challenging because only 20 to 30% of the restaurants that are listed for sale actually sell on the market. And there's 900 restaurants for sale right now in the state of Texas. There's 500 in Georgia. There's over 1,500 in the state of Florida that are currently on the market for sale. And you got to think only 20, 30% will actually sell. So what happens to the other ones? A lot of times they close, the landlord takes it because they're behind in rent. So it's a lot of sad stories when it comes to the restaurant industry.
Yeah. And I can imagine like the first thing that comes to mind when we're talking about rents, I'm thinking of location, somebody pays for this location, they commit to it. And I'm just thinking of how many people built their restaurant model around office workers and people like that. So they get a location near office buildings, commuters, people, you know, that are coming in and out every day and maximizing that. And then the pandemic hits and then everyone goes home and then most people don't come back. And now you have a restaurant in a spot where there's just nobody coming back to office buildings and things like that.
I can only smile because I started my business 6 months before the pandemic hit, October 2019. My first deal was actually canceled because of COVID. Wow. Yeah, my very first deal was canceled because the buyer was like, I can't buy it. It was in March of 2020. So when you say that, so yeah, but now you don't see that as much because restaurant owners or people looking at buying restaurants, they understand that, hey, people may not be coming back to these offices like they were before. Mm-hmm. So you have some of those restaurant sellers that are trying to sell that it makes it even challenging because the population has went down and their sales have went down on those locations.
So you said the first one is the rent percentage as far as a metric. What's the other one? You said there was a second one that
cost of goods sold.
Okay.
So depending on the concept, it should be anywhere from 28 to 35%.
Okay. If you're listening to this and thinking, I want this level of authority, I just don't have the time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. And that's what we build for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and authority signals, everything you need that we've talked about here. So if you want this impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it would look like for your business. Now back to the episode.
And once you see that those numbers are not within those numbers, so if I get a restaurant owner that says, hey, their cost of goods is only 10% or 15%, I'm like, let me look because that's not within the range. Or if I get a restaurant owner that says, hey, the cost of goods is 44%, 45%. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? So as a restaurant broker, I know exactly what numbers to ask about that the buyer is going to ask about, or the buyer can come in and make changes to improve it. I have some restaurant owners that haven't increased their price points for 2 or 3 years. Well, we know what's happened with the cost of goods. It's went up. And if you're not increasing, then your cost of goods are going up. So there is a lot of that when it comes to this industry that's different than other industries.
With the one where I'm super curious, the one where you said where it's like 10% cost of goods, how is that possible? What are they saying they're doing, but they're not doing? Cause you said it's a red flag as well.
That's the thing. It's not possible.
So, I was like, how are they doing that? That's amazing.
Exactly. It's not possible. But if you are a restaurant buyer and you don't have a broker representing you, you can look at those numbers. If you go to a seller directly and be like, oh, wow, 10%, and not know that, no, something's going on, or they move that number around. So, yeah, when I say the restaurant industry has a lot of creative accounting,
yeah,
it has a lot of creative accounting.
So that 10% cost of goods is more than just using yesterday's leftovers and today's soup of the day, or the special tonight is yesterday's leftover fish. You're saying it's more than that?
It's a lot more than that. it's a lot more. Yeah.
I've spent enough years in restaurants in the back of the house, in the front of the house. So I know how that game works of, try not to waste anything. And it's interesting too, because the restaurant that I worked at, this was in college and right after college, I would say family run, but it was like one guy, he owned it, had owned it for a really long time, staff in place. I have no idea what his exit plan would have been. He came in every day. He sat in the office every day. He didn't have to do everything, but he was definitely involved. And, I just wonder, like, what is that exit plan? And when, like you said, comes to something where it's not a strategy of exiting, it's like life events, things that happen, and then there's nobody else who's going to take it over. You're going to try to sell it to the manager that's been in place, and are they qualified to buy it? I don't know how often you see that as well.
A lot of times the managers aren't going to be qualified because they won't get approved by the landlord. Because just because a restaurant seller wants to sell their location, the buyer still has to get approved by the landlord. And a lot of times the landlord will have certain qualifications or certain financial requirements that a manager can't meet.
Got it. Makes sense. So franchise or restaurant brokerage, moved to Texas, whole different world there, whole different opportunity. Now you're not just focused on Texas, right? When it comes to restaurants.
That's correct. I sell in about 15 states.
Okay. Got it. And then I know one of the things that you also focus on is the world of franchises. And I know there's pros and cons. I know there's the positives of it because it's easier to deal with. And then there's the approvals and all that structure. So, where has that fit in? How does that change the landscape? You got the family run founder restaurants, and then you've got the franchise model. Like how dramatically different is that in your world?
Well, it adds another stipulation to the asset purchase agreement because you have to add franchisor approval. And franchisor approval is kind of biased. it's really the franchisor gets to interview the buyer, and the buyer can interview the franchisor to make sure it's a good fit. But sometimes the franchisor say, hey, this person doesn't fit into our culture of what we're looking at doing here, so we're not going to approve them. Even though they had an asset purchase agreement with the seller, the franchisor is the next level that has to approve. And then there's so many different things that come with the franchise approval. My biggest thing that it's something that I don't like is sometimes the franchisor will send the buyer to go to a new state. Like I've had to send a buyer to from Texas to Florida for 3 weeks to go for training. The buyer has to pay for travel, lodging, have to be away from their home for 3 weeks before they can even buy the location. So that's a huge, if you have a franchisor that's in a cold destination, nobody's wanting to go up there in the wintertime to Chicago to make pizzas. Like, so it can be a challenge when you're dealing with some of these franchise concepts.
I live in Florida and there is a McDonald's manager training center that pass by regularly. I'm sure it's less resistance to come here for manager training than, like you said, somewhere cold in the middle of winter.
Exactly. But it's additional cost that comes with that too.
And it's, and then, and it's, and you got to factor that in, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They have to factor that in when it comes to negotiating. And then also when you ask about franchise, so there's different layers with franchise transfer because you have a transfer fee that has to be covered. That transfer fee goes directly to the franchise. It doesn't go to the seller. You may have some store upgrades that are required. The franchise says, hey, there's going to be some new upgrades, some signage, or some, we're going to do a new color scheme. You're going to be responsible for that. Now franchises are pushing, well, hey, if you come in and buy this location, we want you to open 3 or 4 locations within the next 5 years. And we want you to give us that transfer fee money for that up front. So there's different layers when it comes to selling a franchise. The reason I like selling franchises is because they sell at a faster rate than non-franchises. Because most franchises, their books and records have to look a certain way. Mm. Or for non-franchises, you can be creative as you want. Yeah. Like, how'd you get that magic? Like, well, as a franchise, it's usually more standard, and there's more ways that I can check their numbers. So I love selling franchises, but also I like dealing with non-franchises. I like dealing with the mom and pop shops because a lot of times they're not educated about the resale process. They just got into the business to start a restaurant. They never got into thinking about how do I sell? How do I exit? What's the correct way? Who do I contact? And that's been such a blessing for me to actually help people out in those situations.
It's interesting too, because if we think of like the founder-led restaurant, which is a weird way to say it, right? You think of that with like tech startups and things like that. But, you know, and you're also, if people are familiar with Michael Gerber's E-Myth Revisited and that concept of like a technician who starts a business, usually an entrepreneurial spasm is what he referred to it as. And then you think of restaurants as like this chef, this person who's like, I have a concept, I have an idea, I have a menu, gone to school, I've worked in restaurants, I can do this, like this will be easy. And then they're really good at the kitchen aspect, maybe some front of the house, but not all the other stuff. Usually not the sales, the marketing, the admin, the bookkeeping, all that stuff. And so, you know, even not intentionally bad, you know, bad intentions, but just negligent of just like, I just want to be in the kitchen and cook and I don't want to deal with all this other stuff, right? Unless they have a business partner and it's like that, but that's probably not who you're dealing with. You're dealing with somebody like, I remember when I almost had a spasm and I'm like, I'm going to start a paleo food truck and sit outside CrossFit gyms. That's what I'm going to do. And then I ran the numbers and I'm like, this is a terrible job. Like 18 hours a day. This is a terrible job. Like this is no money in it. And so I stopped myself, but like, how many people end up getting into it and then again get to a life situation where it's like, I got this thing, I need to get rid of it, which I know part of what you told me before we hit record is, you know, you got a lot of good things going. We'll talk about that. I'm excited about some of the stuff you have going on, but also a wave of some tough conversations you're having to have with business owners as well, right?
It's more tough conversations than comfortable conversations that I'm having. Because I always ask people like, do you have a price in mind? And my second question is, how did you come up with that price? And I get all type of great answers. Well, that's just what I put into it. That's my build out cost. You know, that's the amount that I owe to pay a loan. And restaurant valuations aren't based off what you need. It's based off your results. And it's a lot of tough conversations. You know, I have I have this guy and I tried to use an example. He's telling me, hey, I want this price point before I even see his numbers. I want this price point. And I'm like, have you ever went to the doctor and just said, hey, I want these results? I don't care. I don't care about anything you see. Or I want this result. It doesn't work that way. You know, I have to look at all your symptoms and your numbers and stuff like that. It's a challenging position. You have to be comfortable and you have to be comfortable being honest. When I first got into the business, some listings I would just take and not knowing I'm not going to be able to sell them. But I'm just like, hey, I got to get some listings. I got to get some listing because in this business, you can list for whatever price you want. You can put it on BizBuySell or these different. No one is not going to sell. I'm at the point now. It's when I get valuations, I'm thinking, how do we sell it? Who's going to be our buyer? How's that buyer going to finance it? If I have a restaurant listed for $1 million, I know one buyer is not going to come and put $1 million on that listing. He's probably going to look for bank financing. So I got to make sure that that listing has multiple years of tax returns and those tax returns look good for SBA lending because I use SBA lending guidelines. So when I ask sellers, how did you come up with their price point? And they give me just this Oof. What I tell them is I use SBA guidelines. So if a bank wouldn't accept it, then I can't accept it when I'm doing my valuation. So it's a lot of education that I provide to restaurant sellers and also restaurant buyers when it comes to this, when it comes to this process.
Before a seller ever speaks to you, they look you up. They scan your name, they search your LinkedIn, they read your last few posts, and in about 60 seconds, they decide whether you feel like a trusted advisor or just another broker. Most brokers never see that moment, but it happens every day. That's why we built the Digital Impact Assessment. It's a structured evaluation of how your online presence actually shows up in four ways: authority, positioning, visibility, and engagement. And if you want to know what sellers are seeing before they book a call with you, just remember you can't improve what you don't measure. All right, now back to this amazing conversation.
Restaurant sellers and also restaurant buyers when it comes to this, when it comes to this process.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's always that newness, that new factor, right? I'm thinking somebody who's new in some kind of like 100% commission only job, whether it's real estate, business brokerage, commercial real estate, mortgage lending, where you just want to take anybody who says, yes, let's go. And maybe there's a chance, maybe there's hope, you don't know better. Your value of your time is essentially $0 because you don't know, right? And so, and you know, some aspect of that, I think for many people when they're new and unguided, don't have a good mentor. And then you get to a point where it's like, it's not worth it. It's not worth it for you. It's not worth it for me. I value my time more. And then it's interesting. I think about that example of the person who's telling you the value and what it should be, and your retort with like going to the doctor. When I was in the mortgage business a long time ago, I was taught this phrase, which I love too, which is prescription before diagnosis is malpractice.
Very
use that one. And so prescription before diagnosis is malpractice, which means if the doctor just gives you a prescription without a diagnosis and checking you out, if anything goes sideways, they're at fault, right? There's malpractice. The difference in your industry is there is no malpractice insurance, right? Like maybe in the 17 states where you need to be a real estate, you know, broker and have a license, but you know, there's not. And so that makes that weird dynamic where people are like, here's the value, let's go sell it. If you won't do it, I'll find somebody else, which then leads to this 20 to 30% stat.
Exactly. And I'm at the point in my brokerage where we turn down more listings than we take on. Because if a seller's unreasonable with us up front, there's no reason for us to spend our time, effort, and our money on trying to sell a listing that I know is not going to be sold. And then the second thing before a point that I want to make sure I remember is when we were talking, one of the hardest restaurants to sell is a chef-driven restaurant where the owner is the chef. Because most people that are buying restaurants, they're not going to come in to be a chef. So when I'm talking to people that own chef-driven concepts, I always ask, do you have a sous chef? Do you have your recipes in books? And do you have your recipes online? And a lot of times it's no. No, I'm the cook. I do everything. It's all in my head. And I'm just like, that's a restaurant that's not going to be able to be sold.
Yeah. Yeah. And there might be, there's always a price, right? This is what I've learned from great brokers like yourself. So there's always a price that something can be sold. It might be really low. Right. There's some value in it, hopefully, unless you have one of those terrible leases where you don't even have the equipment. But it's never going to match what that person is expecting. Right. There's always a price, but it's probably not in line with what that person has done, because what they don't realize, that owner chef concept, they don't realize is they've basically given themselves a job that no one wants to buy.
Exactly. And most times they're not paying themselves for that job.
No. And they can't, right? When they look at the books, they go, man, I can't afford somebody I can step back and just run this place. Like they have to do it in that model. And again, that goes kind of back to the whole concept of like, it's a person who's a chef, but not the business person, not the person who's looking at all those angles and partnered with it. So it's interesting. Do you think this wave of like more tough conversations than easier conversation, especially about value and expectations and what people run to. Is this a developing wave? Is this something causing this? Is it the baby boomers, silver tsunami, and people are just getting to this point in life? Or is there any like economic forces, other things that you're seeing causing this?
The restaurant industry is just a tough industry to survive in. Yeah. And it's just a high failure rate. Anytime someone calls me and I ask them, why are you selling? They say, I'm tired. I know. they got to get out of the business. If you're tired, everything else is going to fall apart. And I talk with so many broken people. I've had multiple people cry on the phone. You know, they're putting their all into this restaurant. It's their nest egg. It's everything. And then, you know, think about if you put you put everything you have into something that fails. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of people that come with certain pride, like, hey, I knew this was going to be successful and it didn't. Now, can you help me get out of this situation? And then they come to me for an honest valuation. And it's like, wow, it's a reality shock to people. But what I tell people is at the end of the day, if this is something that you're tired, you need to sell. When you wake up in the morning, you say, I'm tired, I'm burnt out. It's time to sell. It's time to get out of the industry and get what you can. You may not get what you want, but get what you can.
Yeah. And just get out, especially because that moment when you realize you're tired, it's probably past the point of which you should have sold. Because like you said, other things are slipping. You're just burnt out. Definitely don't wait any longer. Like, it's only going to get worse if you just, you know, kind of drudge on, put your head in the sand.
That is correct. And then also most sellers need to realize is they should sell when their numbers are up, not when their sales are dipping. There's some sellers, I'm going to keep my restaurant. It's going up and up and up. That's a great time to put it on the market to get max value for your concept. Don't call me after your numbers have dipped 2 years and be like, oh, I want max value now. Like, nah, it doesn't really work that way. So timing is really big when it comes to this industry. Timing and planning and extra strategy is really big. And I love when my sellers contact me a year before they're ready to sell. Let's look at your books and records now. Let's give you a valuation. And maybe there's some tweaks that you may need to make to get max value when you're ready to exit. So these are all things that as a restaurant broker, a lot of my job is selling restaurants, but a lot of it is education, providing education on the restaurant resale process.
And, you know, it's a concept that's come up here many times in the podcast with the guests and the brokers, where it's like as much time as possible to plan for it. Like you said, early on in this conversation, you said that, you know, most aren't planning. They don't have an exit strategy. They didn't build it to sell. It's not something where there's, you know, they're going to build this one, then they're going to have some other locations, and then they're hopefully sell it off to private equity and, you know, have it become a thing. They're not, you know, most of them aren't like, hey, I'm going to build this, start this restaurant so it can become a franchise nationwide. Some do, and you hear about those, but most don't, right? And so they're just like doing it and then they want out. I think it's interesting. Obviously, the more time people can do, the better. And yeah, I'm sure it's tough. I'm sure the conversations you have to have, you know, again, not just tough business-wise, having to tell people no, or they can't get what they think they get, but like just the human aspect.
Yeah, I hate to disappoint people, but I take a very honest approach. And I think that's why more than almost about 40-50% of my business is through referrals. So yeah. I have so many different referral partners that refer me their clients. And even if I don't take on the listing, I'll call my referral partner like, hey, the reason I didn't take on this listing because they were unreasonable price point or it's something I feel like I can't deliver on their results. I'd rather tell them no up front than take on their listing and disappoint them. There's brokers that take listings at very high price points, knowing that they're going to ask for price reduction after a month or after two. And I'd rather not use that that approach when it comes to taking on listings.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to do something I've never done on the show before. So Dominique, your special first time guest where I'm doing this is I have a review that was left for you. It was a good one. Don't worry. Don't sweat it. It's a good one. I told you before we hit record, this isn't a controversial show. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But I haven't done this before where I like found a review. You actually posted it. And then I was reading it and I was like, this is so valuable. And I just want to kind of understand some of it. Again, I don't know who's going to find our conversation here. It could be another broker that wants to improve their business. It could be a restaurant owner that follows the digital breadcrumbs to get to this episode to learn more about you. You know, could be buyers out there or whatever. And when I read this review, I thought it was fascinating. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll put it in the show notes so people can find it. Obviously, they can find your stuff as well. But essentially, it starts with, we had already heard no from brokers who didn't think this deal could be done. And you believed that it could versus what others. And then it says, this wasn't an easy deal. It was complex, challenging, the kind of transaction that most brokers tap out on. But this is exactly why Eats Brokers exists. Love to know, like, because again, you just got done talking about how discerning you are. And it's like deals that you know have a chance, right? Like it's high quality. There's the price, the valuation matches up with what the market should do. And then the success comes from, you know, converting more of those. This sounds like one where it was like nobody else wanted to touch it. Where is that different, or what was different about that one, or what did you do?
Well, I'm a specialist in what I do. So even when I looked at his numbers, I said, hey, this is where the valuation is. These are the challenges that we're going to be dealing with. These are the type of buyers that we're going to look towards. And even when we got the buyer, it was challenging to get the deal closed because there were so many obstacles that came up. The good thing as a broker, I already knew some of these things that were going to come up. So I said, hey, this is going to come up. Hey, this is going to come up. This is going to come up. So it's just being a specialist in what I do. I've been doing it for 14 years. So there's things that other brokers that may say, hey, can't be done. And I'm looking at it like, oh, this is easy. Why would they tell you that? Like, why would they? No, come over here. Let's sign this listing agreement. So I definitely appreciate that Google review, because it was a really challenging deal. And I think if someone wasn't a specialist in knowing the knowledge that I have about closing deals, they might not have got it done, because a lot of it was educating the buyer about the process and what the buyer should expect. And then it was just dealing with different challenges. And that's why the restaurant industry, it's so unique. Like, the only thing I sell was restaurants, bars, and nightclubs. I literally am a foodie. If it doesn't involve food, I probably won't touch it because I don't understand it. Like, there's a reason I have certifications behind my name. I have a certified business intermediary from the International Business Brokers Association. Just means I'm pretty good at doing valuations and I'm a business broker, and I have a certified franchise executive designation. Just means I understand franchising. And most franchise companies, people that are in their franchise department have a CFE. So I wanted to be a restaurant broker that specializes in businesses, but also specializes in selling franchising. So that's why I decided to get those two certifications behind my name. And I'm only one of two brokers in the nation that actually know that have those two destinations behind their name.
Wow. I think it's great. And I think it's fascinating to think of it, because many times on this show with guests, we have a conversation about specializing, industry, niche. And I've had several industry specific brokers on the show and talk about the value of that. And then I have some, you know, mostly it's generalist brokers. Sometimes it's brokers who are anti-specialist and they have their reason for it. And it's interesting, because when I hear you talk and the other specialists that I've had on the show and the ones I know, is it makes so much sense. You focus on restaurants, bars, and nightclubs. See, I got it down. Like, I've listened to you enough times. Like, I got it. you know, so you focus on that. You know that well. You can look at the numbers. You know where, you know, they're hiding things or what doesn't make sense quickly. And then, you know, to your point of what you said too, which is where I think any broker, any salesperson becomes an expert, is when you can see the future. Like, this is what I've always told people. Like, you want to be a professional salesperson, you need to be able to see the future and know what's coming before it happens. Know what people are going to think, know what people are going to ask before they think and ask it. At that mode there, then the game is totally different, right? Because at that point, you already know what the buyer's thinking or what they should be thinking. And you and your seller are prepared, because when that comes up, you have an answer. Nothing is worse than, I don't know why that's like that. Or I don't know why we're missing all that info or money or whatever it is, right?
Well, I know, and I'm going to touch on this later, but people always think, ask me, like, how is AI affecting our business?
Yeah.
But what AI can do is pivot like a human can do. And so AI can give you the guideline, but what about if a pivot happens? It's like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. Or I didn't put that prompt in. That's definitely the difference in working with a human and AI, is knowing how to pivot and also knowing the emotional. If you feel like you got to be able to read the room over the phone, like if you know that the buyer is having some type of gut, it's like, hey, let's talk about this. I feel that you're changing, or I feel that you have some concerns. Let's discuss this. Let's dig a little deeper into the situation. So as a broker, sometimes you're a counselor. I mean, yeah, you definitely have to be able to pivot. And, you know, I say I'm a counselor, but at the end of the day, I'm a quarterback. I'm touching everybody on the deal. And that's what I love about the industry, is multitasking and being able to touch so many different people to help everyone get to the closing table.
some days as a sales professional, which is what you are and most people in business are, should feel like therapy sessions because people are sharing things, you're coaching them, you're guiding them. It's life, right? It's the human aspect, which we'll touch on AI and technology in the after show, but you're right. It's the stuff that it can't do that we need and we will always need. We are a tribal society, so we need each other. And, you know, and business is tough and selling a business is not something that anyone is prepared to do or practiced or, you know, has any experience with. So none of it makes sense, which is why there's you. So let's move into the next section because I know you have a good list. I'm excited because it's going to bring up some stuff, which is the broker growth segment. So this is your playbook for what you've done. You've been in it for 14 years. You've had your brokerage from the beginning before a pandemic, then through a pandemic. And then, you know, after that, in a field that was dramatically affected by the pandemic, like in the restaurants, like everyone basically shut down the whole model. Everyone put tables out front if they were lucky, handed people food, go away kind of model. So you weathered all of that. So let's talk about your growth tips, the things that you found works really well. You know, what do you have on that list?
One of the biggest things I have is being able to tell your story and be comfortable telling your story. So yes, I own Eats Broker, but also there's a lot more behind my story besides just owning Eats Broker. And then also it's the big thing is if someone can say 1 to 4 words, what they think of you. If someone says restaurants, I want them to think of Dominique the Restaurant Broker. And if someone can't say 1 to 4 words and think about you, then you may want to kind of think about what you're doing or the message that you are providing to people. One of the big things is networking. When you're out networking, being able to tell your story. Because people, who are you? How did you start that? Mm-hmm. What makes you unique? Why do you stand out? And I'm always telling people, I only do restaurants, bars, and nightclubs. If it's anything else, I'm going to push it to another broker. I'm not going to try to learn any other industry. And then also just telling the story of how I started and what makes me different than other brokers. Well, I'm very honest when it comes to my valuations. I turn down more listings that I take on. That's kind of my story behind that.
Yeah. And I think it's good. I think, you know, as humans, we like stories. It also helps make sense of it. And I think one of the things that's valuable when you tell your story and all the stuff that you've gone through, both in life, but then also in your career arc with restaurant brokerage, that's important, is that the people you talk to now, you can tell that story that builds up to the reason why you are the guide, not the hero, but you're the guide that can help them as the hero restaurant owner succeed in their journey, right? Yes. Like you've got the scars, you've got the battle wounds, you've survived, right? Like you've gone through things and you understand it in a way that's fascinating about you because it's also not from being in the restaurant industry or owning a restaurant or owning a business, right? Many brokers, they come to business brokerage after owning a business, exiting in some fashion of some kind of business and then getting into it. But you took a different path, but at this point right now, you've earned the stripes and able to tell the story.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a blessing to even still be here because most business brokers are only in the business for 2 years or less. And I've been in the business 14 years, have my own brokerage for 7 years. I have a broker under me that's been with me for 1 year that's going to have his best year this year. So it's been a super blessing of where I'm actually been. But also I would also say is focus on your brand. I'm big on branding and I'm big on anytime you see me, I'm wearing an Eats Broker shirt. Why would I wear any other brand than my own brand? So it's telling your story and also building on your brand. And also, like you brought up a good point, is letting the seller be the hero. All these people go to, like some of these brokers, they go and they want to be the hero of the story. I can do this. I can do this. And I'm just like, no, I want you to be the hero. Let me just help you out. Let me just understand what you're going through. I ask more questions than I do talking on the phone when I'm talking to my seller. If I've talked more than my seller or if I don't have multiple notes, I didn't do my job on the phone.
Yep. It's so true. It's such an important thing to focus on. And I think most professionals, if they've done something long enough, they get into that mode where they realize, right? Their job is not to be the hero. Their job is not to talk. They just want to get information and then connect the dots, you know? Mm-hmm. But I appreciate you saying that because it's a good reminder. The thing I joke about with everybody is, you know, 2 ears, one mouth. Listen is twice as much as you talk, and right. You'll generally do well. And then whenever I have dealt with salespeople in the past, you know, they're like, what should I do? It's like, if you ever feel yourself talking too much, just stop and ask a question.
Yes.
That's it. Even if it's halfway through, I've done that to myself where I'm like halfway through a sentence. I go, you know what? Hold on. And then I ask a question. I just literally hit the brakes on myself because I can feel like I'm monologuing. And nothing good comes from salespeople monologuing too much, right? If you got to explain right. something, that's one thing. But I want to go back to the brand part that you mentioned. It is very true. And I think there's not enough of this out there with business brokers. Now, you have a unique position because you're specialized. So it's, you know, you got the Eats brokerage, you're Mr. Restaurant Broker. That's how I introduce you. That's how I think of you. That's how I will always think of you. Restaurants, bars, and nightclubs. And like you've done a good job with that, right? And like, there's so much more you could be doing with marketing and branding and like doing way more. But like with what you're doing, it's on point and it's, you know, you want it to be synonymous, right? Like Kleenex and Xerox and like all of these brands, like just want that to be your thing. And I think where, you know, a lot of brokers don't do that. They're just so generalist and they're just so like kind of with the crowd. And they're not doing enough of that. Even if they don't have an industry specialization, like do people know who they are and what they do?
I agree. One point I definitely wanted to bring up is, you know, people ask me, how did I become successful? And one of the biggest ways is finding ways to put myself in rooms with some of the best in the industry. And that's something that I've definitely aligned myself up with. Even when I go to these different conferences, I look to see who the different speakers are. I look to see the top brokers that are going to be there. And I'm always doing a beeline to go meet these people and always think iron sharpens iron. So I go to a lot of conferences. I'm always learning something new. I'm always doing different, I'm listening to podcasts when I'm walking. I'm going to the IBBA conference in May. I'm going to the Texas Association of Business Brokers conference in September. There's always learning because I want to put myself in the room with the sharpest in the industry and let them know I'm a restaurant broker. I'm not competition. So it builds me a great way of networking. One of the things that my broker, my new broker, Duran, the restaurant broker, told me was in his first year, one of the biggest keys that he learned was networking is key. He realizes how I get a lot of my deals are through referrals. And it's through networking of people that I've met over the years that know that Dominic is the guy to go to for restaurants, bars, and nightclubs.
That's it. I think it's so great. So, and I love that too about the iron sharpens iron. Because I think, you know, with the right mindset, with a growth mindset and a healthy ego, you always want to learn, right? I think there's a lot out there that says, you know, if you tell somebody your goals and your dreams and they support you, it's the right person, right? The wrong people will laugh at you or tell you it's not possible. The right people will be like, yeah, why not? Let's do it. Like, yes, of course, right? And so looking for those rooms to get the support and to learn. What else on your list? That's an amazing list. Like if brokers I talked to did a few of those, like they would be off to the races.
So another big thing is to be comfortable in a pressure cooker. This business has a lot of pressure to it. I had a panic attack in 2018 that changed the way I looked at working deals. I was so stressed about the deal. I needed the deal to close so I can have the down payment to a house, and just had a panic attack at my house. And it's changed the way that I've looked at things. So this is a very, it can be at times very stressful, but you have to be comfortable. You have to be comfortable when you're down. And so that's one of my biggest things that I always tell my my other broker is, hey, man, this it can be pressure, but you can handle it. You know, you got to just be comfortable and confident in yourself, in your process, in your systems that you have.
I love it. And I know that one of the things that you said in the first part that we were talking about was also in my notes. It was in the conversation that we talked about is a why, right? And not why question mark, but why, like remember your why, what you're focused on. How does that play in for you? And why is that an important part of your journey, the story that you tell, and then also what drives you?
Well, the reason I brought up that, because you have to remember your why when times are hard. Life is easy when things are going your way, but when it's hard, you're ready to break. It's like, why did I even start this? Well, I started it because I opened up the first Black-owned restaurant brokerage firm in the nation. When I wanted to start my brokerage, there's no one that looked like me that I can talk to and say, hey, how did you start that? Or so now I got to the point where there's other minorities that are contacting me and say, hey, Dominic, you're a broker. We didn't even know it existed. And so that's been really rewarding. And my why was an example. I wanted to be an example. If I could do it, you can do it. It doesn't matter if you don't see other people that look like you that are successful. All you need to see is one face. And if you can see one face, you can see it's possible. So, and then also being a great example for my daughter, showing her that, hey, your father started a business that's successful. You know, your father started a business that you can Google and you can go and ChatGPT and my name comes up. You can look at me. I have 25-star Google reviews. Your father started this from his home and look how successful he is. So I have so many whys that I jump out of the bed when I get up every morning. I'm so thankful I have another opportunity to work on my whys. And it really helped me. Like if you have a big deal that falls apart and you're like, you just remember your why. Why'd you start it? You know, it wasn't, not one time did I say my why was to make a lot of money. My why was so many different other purposes. The money comes with it. And so that's what motivates me. And I think that's what, if brokers, when they come into this business, they need to write their why on a board or something like that. So when they get hard, they can look at that why and remember it.
Yeah. And it's a fundamental thing. Like if you want to be successful at something, right? And success is defined by you, whatever you define success in, right? And then also at something that could be anything. It could be fixing cars. It could be building house, like whatever that is, success and the what. If you have a big enough why, you will persevere, right? The why has to be bigger than whatever challenges and obstacles. And now I sound like some kind of Jim Rohn motivational thing, but it's true, right? Like you gotta have that why. And dealing with salespeople and business people for a long time now, it's like the ones that have the big why, the rejections, the deals that fall apart, the struggles, the challenges, you know, you're just gonna figure it out. You're gonna keep going and you're not gonna quit. You might fail, you'll make mistakes, but you're not gonna quit. And so I really appreciate that about you. I remember the first time we spoke and I was like, oh man, this guy is driven. This guy is focused. And again, not the money, not number of deals, not awards, not plaques, you know, in those things. It's just doing what you do. So,
but also
why I appreciate you.
Yeah. So. But also I have a chip on my shoulder. I came from less, you know, and when you come from less, you have a chip on your shoulder. Like, hey, I know I'm just as good as that guy right there. He may be with a bigger company. That doesn't mean he's better than me. And then also one nugget I forgot to drop is outwork your competition. When I got into this business, the reason I was successful is I had a goal. I had my note in a brochure and I used to go foot canvas into different restaurants. And my goal was to drop 25 brochures a week. Going in, walking to the restaurant, say, hey, can I talk to the owner? This is a brochure. Have you ever thought about selling your restaurant? Have you ever thought about relocating? People won't do that today. I can tell that to many people as I want. This is what I did. This is how I was successful. But people don't want to do that because that's uncomfortable. That makes you feel uncomfortable walking into a restaurant, saying, hey, can I talk to the owner and give them a brochure with your information? But that's how I started my business. And that's how I'm successful now, is I feel like I outwork some of my competition. I cannot work all my competition, and I can't do everything that they can do. But there are certain different things that I can do to outwork them to make sure that I'm successful and I'm still growing my brokerage.
Yeah. And when you combine the healthy amount of chip on the shoulder, underdog mode, like I've always felt like I'm an underdog. So like I have that same mode. I know that you've been through a lot. Get that healthy chip on the shoulder. That's like a positive force, like driving you forward and not like a self-destruction force, combined with the why and then outworking everybody. Like it's no surprise why you've gotten here. No doubt where you're going from here. Yeah. And I appreciate you sharing all that. Now let's shift one more time. Let's talk about the unpleasant side of business brokerage, more than the tough conversations that you have to have with people, which is the deal that got away. So this section here is a part that I enjoy for the lessons, not because I like to bring up bad stuff. I don't want to go into therapy mode and make you talk about all kinds of terrible trauma and let's expose that to the world. But you know, the lessons from the lost deal. There's deals that happen and they should have gone through and they didn't, and something or someone caused it to not go through. And so I would love to hear what you have from your world and experience and perspective, and like, what are the lessons from it? What are the cautionary tales that others can take from it?
So I had a deal last year where it was a franchise and the landlord approved the buyer. All we needed was the franchisor to approve the buyer. The buyer went out for a discovery day, meaning they went to the corporate office and met with everyone. And after that, the corporate office decided that the buyer wasn't a good cultural fit. Now, I had never really heard that term, cultural fit, into their business. Now, he was a second-generation American, and there were some issues with, you know, communication. So what it taught me was that, yeah, I can get a deal under contract, but if it's a franchise, that buyer has to get approved by that franchise or it's not going to work out. I try to coach them up. Hey, this is what they're going to ask for. But at the end of the day, the franchisor is interviewing that buyer and they can say no for any reason that they want. So when you buy a franchise, you have to realize that that one day when you're ready to exit, that person's going to have to go to your franchisor and they can say no. And this was a big deal. This was a $1 million deal. So the buyer wanted, he needed this. And it was in, the seller really needed the deal to close. And the sad part about it was the buyer was contacting me and was just like, why didn't they approve me, Dominique? You know, I have all the money and, you know, why didn't they approve me? And I had to use a term they said was, you weren't a cultural fit. So that was a tough deal. I worked my butt off that deal to not receive anything because they felt like he wouldn't be a good fit. Now, the challenge that we had was he was trying to replace a current franchisee that was really good. Mm. And the franchisor didn't want to see that guy sell because they knew he was a really good operator. Yeah. So he had one of the top locations in the franchise brand. They're like, no, we don't want you out to replace it with this guy that we're kind of. So that was a big deal that got away. And it took me a couple of days to get over that, because as the broker, like, I did my job. I brought you someone that was financially had the money, who's excited about the opportunity. And you guys just say no. And that's happened multiple times. Franchise brands can say no for any reason that they want. So yeah, you said one that got away, multiple that got away from franchise approval. And so I try to coach buyers up. Hey, this is what the franchise is going to ask you. This is what you should know. This is what you should be ready to talk about. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, it's a tough one because it's out of your control. There's only so much coaching. You can't predict and assume what they're looking for. So you can't filter it out in the, you know, the buyer assessment process. Like, you just kind of got to do it and then hold on as it goes through that. And it's tough too, because, like, you know, how much of that part that you said is accurate, where the franchisee was doing well and they didn't want to see that person leave, which goes to what we talked about earlier in the show, where most people don't sell on top. Humans are terrible at, like, taking their chips and going home when they're ahead, right? And so you've got someone who is actually doing that and trying to get out while they're doing well, and then the other forces are like, no, you stay here with us, and then they can't even do it.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dominique, I appreciate you being here, sharing so much. This has been fantastic. I've taken a lot of notes. And like I tell everybody, I already knew some of the stuff we're going to talk about, and you dropped some real gems. I really like this. We talked about therapy. We talked about listings. We talked about percentages, some good metrics in there. Hopefully some restaurant business owners find this and, you know, learn about what it's going to take to put this stuff together. For people who want to get in touch with you, luckily you're on brand all the time. So eatsbroker.com, EATSbroker.com.
That's correct.
sales@eatsbroker.com. Email you. Links will be in the show notes. LinkedIn, they'll find you. Dominique Maddox, Eats Broker on Instagram, Restaurant Broker on Facebook. Like, it should be pretty easy to find you. Again, the link will be, links will be everywhere in the show notes. Dominique, I appreciate you being here and sharing so much with the audience.
Hey, definitely appreciate the opportunity. And restaurant owners, we provide complimentary restaurant valuations to our clients free of charge.
And you know, I think that's great. I think it's super important, anyone listening to this, to always start with that. Be careful of your own valuations. I hear stories from brokers all the time of like people, you know, coming up with their own numbers or ChatGPT, you know, it's like the WebMD before you go to a doctor, you're just going to like look something up and tell them what to do. Like we were talking about earlier. Right. And you know, the country club valuation or wherever people get their numbers. So please reach out to Dominique and then stay tuned. We're going to take a break. Then we're going to record the after show, which you'll find also on the podcast stream and in the videos as well. Make sure you support this content. Love having these conversations. So valuable. This is what we need more of out there, and just value to help everybody and educate and, you know, get more people to be successful as brokers, but also, you know, business owners and buyers. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show, hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.